this week, making his second appearance on the show in just a matter of weeks. He can't get enough of us. We need to change our number. It's Matt Johnson, director of Tony.
Hey.
Why did you do that?
Because I
don't
know. Tony.
Hey, Tony.
Tony.
It's Matt Johnson, director of Tony, you schmucks. All that, plus the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast, without even knowing it, had its last Soho special. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined in the pod booth by two colleagues of such lethal cunning, both of whom have also had, at some point, without knowing it, their last Soho specials. We'll explain that in a second. What we geek queen, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
And the mad titan of movies himself, James Dyer.
I am here.
You are here.
Also inevitable.
And you
here.
Are sated. You have eaten, but you've had a lovely itsu for lunch. We had an itsu for lunch also.
Yeah.
It was very, very nice indeed. But we did not have a Soho special at Bodine's. Why did we not have a Soho special
because
at Bodine's?
Because they've closed down.
It seems that they have indeed. Bodine's, which was a London barbecue chain that opened over a long time ago. Anyway, I don't want to age ourselves too
much. We've been going there for two decades. So
shut up, James. We've been going there for like 5 minutes because we're so
super
young.
Young.
Guys. And probably the best barbecue I've ever had. And they did their pièce de résistance was something called the Soho Special, which they would take bits of pulled pork and burnt ends of beef brisket and smoosh them together in this lovely
barbecue sauce,
and they had lovely chips with a little bit of seasoning. And whenever we were working near Oxford Street, and Bodine's opened, whenever it opened, I don't remember what year it was, but probably like last week or something. We went there quite a lot, didn't we, guys?
Sometimes, as you said yesterday, twice in a day.
Sometimes twice a day.
Yeah.
I don't remember going twice in a day.
I went twice a day. I once took a big Hollywood producer to Bodine's, and they were deeply unimpressed.
Oh.
Disgusted, even.
Disgusted, yeah. But yeah, it seems there was an article this week that Bodine's seems to have gone. Hopefully it can come back.
Well,
but,
and not to dance on the grave of Bodine's, but the last time I went there, they had hiked their prices by an extraordinary amount, so much so that the server in the branch I went to actively apologized to me for it. Mm. And that's the last time I ever went in there. So, because I work for Empire and therefore am impoverished.
Yes.
Yeah,
we'll work for barbecue.
Or the Soho specials.
Oh,
so if anyone can help us out with the Soho special, then please do.
Yeah.
Also, the Soho special, we should say, was taken off the menu.
It was off
some
menu.
Years ago.
And
so
then
you had
to
just
know.
You had to be in the note, say, I want a wink, wink, nudge, nudge Soho special. And they'd be like, yes, sir, the walk up is just around the corner.
It's like,
no, I mean the burger. They go, oh, yes, absolutely, I'll get one of those for you.
Anyway, R.I.P. Bodine's, you put a lot of meat in our mouths over the years, and and we appreciated you for that. But now that Bodine's has gone, what are we going to do for lunch? May I suggest Five Guys?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I think we could all do with a salad, actually.
Anyway, how are you both?
I'm good. I'm getting to grips
good
with the end
yeah.
of... I don't know, I'm getting to grips with the end of House of the Dragon for another 2 years.
I feel your accusatory eyes staring
no,
at me.
It's fine, you get somebody else.
What's happening with this? What's
I cheated on Helen this morning.
Yeah.
There was
there was
pod fidelity. I did a spoiler special for House of the Dragon, but just with Boyd. It was good. But Helen was not there, and we did it without her. And for that, all I can do is apologize.
Rude.
Helen was banging against a glass.
Indeed.
I think it's because Helen has big Rhaenyra energy, and we were just afraid.
Hey.
Big what? Helen has what energy?
Yeah, big Rhaenyra, which is not something you catch from a walk up in Soho. It's actually a character from House of the Dragon.
I'm actually going more for Alysanne Blackwood, if I'm honest.
I don't give a shit.
Okay.
Let's move on.
Yay. I also went to see some movie stars on stage this week.
Okay.
I saw The Cherry Orchard.
Oh, is she? I haven't seen her in anything.
By Pavel Chekhov of The Enterprise.
Indeed. With Kenneth Branagh. Wechter.
And the nuclear vessels.
With Kenneth Branagh, Bill Pullman, and Helen Hunt.
Really?
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
Wow. And how was it? Wasn't Branagh...
And like Alfred Enoch and people like that who are also good.
Wasn't it as good as The Mad King?
No, because there were no dragons or giant horses, so... Obviously, the Mad King wins on points.
Inferior. Okay.
This was all like, you know, Russian people being upset about money.
Oh, did Branagh get to do his accent again?
No, he did a Northern Irish accent.
Did he?
He played it Northern Iron. Yeah.
Really?
Yep.
Did he know where he was or where the play was set? What was going on?
I don't know. Maybe he just wanted to change things up. He's done his Russian accent like a lot.
I mean, it varies. I mean, Russia's a big place. You know, the guy in Jack Ryan, Shadow Recruit, is very different from the guy in Mayday.
And the guy in Tenet.
You guys, the guy in Tenet, was he even Russian?
Was he even Russian? I don't know.
He may not have even been Russian.
Ukrainian? Or
possibly.
Yeah.
Some kind of billionaire anyway. But so explain for the idiots at home who don't know what Pavel Chekhov wrote. What is this? Basically, this is the magic seagull.
It's not related to the seagull.
It's more about trees. By the,
okay.
Yeah, it's about, well done, James.
Mm. I have seen the cherry orchard on stage.
Oh, is it cherry orchard? Yeah. I forgot the name of it. Okay.
Yeah, it's the cherry. So it's basically this wealthy family who are led by Helen Hunt and Bill Pullman's characters are faced with the ruination of their old house, and they're having to try and figure out how to save the ancestral home. And the son of a serf made good, who is the Kenneth Branagh character, is going, just build a bunch of holiday cottages. We can make this work.
And just build a whole bunch of holiday cottages.
That's basically 100% what happens. Yes.
Yeah.
And then they're all like, no, we're going to get borrow some money from them. It's going to be fine.
And Alay Northern Irish as well.
No,
or is
they
it just
were American.
Him? Sorry, what?
Yeah, they were doing American accents. So they were kind of like I think it kind of worked because it was kind of like the, you know, movie stars from America coming in, playing the like also glamorous, slightly untouchable nobility.
And who directed this? Was this Bernard directing?
No, he wasn't directing. He was just.
He wasn't directing.
No, he was just. Starring. Okay. Yeah, it's good. It was well done.
Good.
Yeah, it was well done.
Did he put a light bulb in anyone's mouth at any point?
Not that I saw, but like it was heavily implied off stage.
Yeah. Did a light bulb go off over his head when he had a good idea?
Yes. That, well, it was just like the lights, stage lights were over his head all times.
He went, I've had a great idea, so I have.
That's exactly it. My God.
Fantastic. How was his Northern Irish accent? Because obviously he moved away from Belfast when he was just a bairn. I believe he made a movie about it.
I believe he did.
To Oscar winning effect. And he went to Reading and lost his accent. So did he find it again? Or was it a little bit like...
Yeah, it was just on the back of the sofa.
Just on the back of the sofa, so it was. How was it?
Yeah, it was good. Good. Solid. Very solid.
Yeah.
I had a nice time.
Don't sound convinced.
No, I had a nice time. But like I say, it would have been better with a dragon and some horses.
Okay, but most things with this podcast
significantly improved with both, yes.
Dragon, horses, maybe even five guys. I don't know. I'm just saying.
Or a Sappho special.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Can you imagine? So let's have a question, shall we? We have the big question I teased at the end of last week's question section, which was someone sent in a question, and I will find who it was, and said, Chris Nolan's 13th movie is The Odyssey, or The Odyssey is Chris Nolan's 13th movie as director. Is that the best 13th movie by a director? I can't find the person who sent me the question. So if you are the person who sent me the question on Instagram last week saying that The Odyssey is Chris Nolan's 13th movie, is that the best 13th movie by a director, then give yourself a pat on the back and let me know on social media, whatever platform you like, and I will give you your flowers next week. They're metaphorical flowers. We can't afford literal flowers, but I hope you will understand. So guys... The Odyssey is Chris Nolan's 13th movie as director. So we are now considering other 13th movies by directors. Now, this rules out a lot of people. James, this rules out James Francis Cameron. Are you okay? Do you know any other directors? What's happening? He's frozen.
I've double checked my arithmetic. I could be wrong, but there's a possibility I can be granted Dune Part 2.
Okay, go for
it. If I'm avoiding shorts...
You are avoiding shorts.
We should avoid shorts.
There's a possibility I've miscounted. There's a possibility that actually Dune Part 3 is the correct answer, because that would be his 13th.
Four?
Feature-length four.
And you haven't said it for whom?
For Denis Villeneuve.
Yes, okay. Yes. Thank you.
Sorry, I thought that was implied.
yes, but we can assume knowledge on the part of our listeners.
August 32nd on Earth, Maelstrom, right?
Yeah.
Polytechnique,
yeah.
Encendie,
yeah.
Then Prisoners,
yep.
Enemy,
yep.
Sicario,
yep.
Arrival,
that's eight.
Blade Runner,
nine.
Dune Part 1, Dune Part 2.
You're way off. So Dune Part 3 is not
so
even...
So it would have to be Dune Part 4.
So his 13th would be Bond.
Yes, that's
so,
right.
So his Bond movie
his
would
Bond
be his
movie
13th.
Will be the greatest film ever made, yeah.
Okay, all right. So why don't you have a little think about some directors, and I'll turn to Helen. for a second. I've made a long list.
Oh, good. Well,
I've
then
made a long
you could
list.
Have shared that list. That would have been helpful.
I could have, but it'd be much more funny for me to go through it with you guys, or you to list directors, right. And then I've written down a whole bunch of a bunch of people. All right, so Hell's Bells.
What did you get for Spielberg? Because I'm worried I'm miscounting.
Is it Schindler's List?
It is not Schindler's
List. Is it Jurassic Park?
It is not Jurassic
is
Park.
Is it Hook?
It is Hook.
Damn it, that's what I got. Well, and I was hoping I'd miscounted. I'm so close to greatness.
Here is the other thing I have discovered. We're not exhausted, but what I did was I went through a list of everyone who's won a Best Director Oscar, and I went back and looked through the careers. I had a spare hour this morning.
Proper research.
Wow. I did proper research for a question for pretty much the first time in a long, long time. And I found that 13 is generally very unlucky for directors. Mm. That their 13th movie as director, all the enthusiasm and talent and drive that propelled them through their careers has long seeped out of their bodies, replaced by money and Oscars and acclaim, and they're just phoning it in by that point.
Oh no!
And sometimes there's good movies, sometimes there's unfortunate movies, sometimes there's Hook.
Okay, but it's not like the worst 13th movie, I can tell you that right now.
Looking at this list, it's not far off.
Oh,
I'll be honest. All right, do you have anyone else, or shall I go through my little list?
Go through your little list.
I'll go through a little list. Right, I can't be exhaustive.
No.
We can't list every single director in the world, but obviously some directors didn't get to... Michael Mann, for example, hasn't made 13 films.
Quentin Tarantino will never make 13
Quentin
films.
Quentin Tarantino will never make 13 films. Who do we like? Jordan Peele, Rian Johnson, people who've come up recently in the last few years obviously have not hit 13 films yet.
Almost no women directors have had the chance to make 13
Correct,
films.
Helen. Correct. Patriarchy, eh?
Yeah.
Five guys. Ridiculous. This is more like 37
more,
guys.
More than five of them. Yeah.
For Martin Scorsese, I think I'm getting Cape Fear.
You're correct.
Cape That's not Fear. A bad contender.
It's decent.
Not a bad shout.
It's decent. It's very good. Yeah. But is it better than The Odyssey? Better than The Odyssey. Higher than The Odyssey. Is it?
No.
No, it is not. You think. Helen loves The Odyssey.
Is,
she
really
loves
like Odyssey.
The Odyssey.
She does. Is Ridder's Black Hawk Down?
Correct. This is
I like
you're
Black Hawk
very
Down.
Good. I'm very impressed by your counting skills.
It's not. It's not even top five Ridders. Do you know what I mean?
No, like, it's hard to argue with that.
Yeah,
I was hoping it was like Gladiator or something, but no.
I'm not sure Black Hawk Down's top 13 Ridders. To be honest, but, so
it's
I was looking up
Hannibal.
Ridley Scott. I then looked up Tony Scott and his 13th movie.
Oh,
my name is Domino Harvey, and I'm a bounty
hunter.
No, bounty hunter.
Yes.
What a shame.
I'm afraid so. See, 13 unlucky for some.
Just for giving us that line, I think it maybe deserves to win.
Do you think to
no,
win?
Not really.
To win, you're insane. John Carpenter, In the Mouth of Madness, or if you count his television movie Elvis, Then his 13th movie is Memoirs of an Invisible Man. But if you don't, then it's In the Mouth of Madness, which is a good horror film. Obviously, had great Sam Neill in it, but as did Memoirs of an Invisible Man, actually. But no, I don't think that's as good as the Odyssey. Helen, you'll like this. Pedro Almodovar.
Oh, yeah?
All About My Mother.
Oh, I really like that.
Yep.
That's a very good call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. That's my new choice, apart from the Odyssey.
But that's the question.
Oh,
which one, does anyone else have a 13th movie that is as good or as better than the Odyssey? And I think I have a winner, but I'm gonna leave it for a little while. I'm gonna build up to it.
Okay.
So let me see. John Huston, Heaven Knows, Mr. Allison. Yeah. Frank Capra.
Right.
All right. So this list is all over the shop.
Yeah.
With some jiggery pokery, his 13th movie, It Happened One Night.
Sold.
Better than the Odyssey. Five big five Oscars.
Very similar to
big
the Odyssey.
Five.
Very similar. In that they're on a long journey, and have to stay alive and such and fall in love.
Yes. Who does Odysseus fall in love with again?
Well, he's already in love with
Penelope. He's already in love,
you say. But I mean, let's be honest, Clark Gable is pretty much instantly also in love with Claudette Colbert.
Yes.
In It Happened One Night. So, like, he's just trying to get her to realize that.
Yeah.
Also, really depressingly, at one point, he's a journalist, and at one point they give his rate that he's going to be paid for the article he's going to write about this missing era.
Is it more than you're on now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That was 1937.
So that obviously won the big five Oscars.
Yeah, it did.
It won the best film, best director, best screenplay, best actor, best actress. Jimbo, do you think The Odyssey has a shot at that? at this point in time?
No.
Okay.
No.
Which categories do you think it will not triumph of those big five?
I don't think it'll get any acting wins.
I think it might get a supporting actor.
You
I
think?
Don't, maybe. But I don't see it winning Best Actor or Best Actress.
No.
All right. Jimbo, have you found anyone else? Is there any,
no, I was...
Say a director, maybe, and I'll...
Well, I was looking for Clint Eastwood and was disappointed.
Oh, what was it?
Yeah. Well, again, with the counting, but I feel like it's sort of floating around Honky Tonk Man. I can't quite work it out, but I'm trying to.
Bird.
Is it Bird?
It's Bird.
Oh, did I miss?
His 13th film as director.
Oh, Bird. Is Bird. Right, it's after Harbour Bridge. Yes,
which is a good film.
Right. Yeah.
It's a good film, but is it as good as The Odyssey?
No.
No, I would argue.
I was hoping that Unforgiven, but Unforgiven was like about four films later, so yeah.
Ah, didn't work. Okay.
Is Franz Ford Coppola The Outsiders? Am I
no.
counting that right?
No, I don't believe you are. Francis Ford Coppola, I have him down as directing. Holy shit. Peggy Sue Got Married.
Oh, that's interesting.
So,
I like
that
movie. It's a fine movie. It's not as good as The Odyssey.
Brian De Palma, Dressed to Kill.
Mm. Okay.
Robert Zemeckis, The Polar Express. Mm. You see, right? Mm.
Regrettable.
13. It is so unlucky for some. Steven Soderbergh, Solaris.
Mm.
Right? I mean, it's just, it doesn't seem to work. Except when you get to Sam Raimi.
Oh, God.
Uh-huh.
For Love of the Game. No, only kidding. All's Great and Powerful. No, only kidding. Drag Me to Hell.
Good film.
Good movie.
Good film. Not better
good
than The Odyssey.
Movie.
It's much better than The Odyssey. It is far superior, I would argue.
You could argue that.
Of course, I guess The Odyssey is Drag Me to Hades, isn't it?
Hey.
Bit of a joke there. Do you want anyone else?
Billy Wilder?
Billy Wilder at 7-Year Itch.
Oh, come on. That's a great movie.
It's a great movie. Is it better than The Odyssey? Remember the bit in The Odyssey where the wind blows Matt Damon's toga up? There's a big old bag of wind. Do you remember that? All right, the Coen brothers?
Yeah, you told me this. It's not great, is it?
Did I tell you this? I don't think I did.
Well,
I don't think
did.
I did. It's very good. It's one of my favorite Coen brothers movies.
Oh, is it A Country for Old Men?
No.
No.
No. The year after, though.
Man Who Wasn't There?
No. Burn After Reading.
I mean, I love the Coens. You know this about me.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't put that in their top five.
Oh, that's top five Coens for me. Absolutely. I adore that film. It's so fucking funny.
Meh.
I mean, Brad Pitt wears a good tracksuit.
All right. Sorry, I'm just moving your names to twats. Column marked twats.
As if they weren't there already.
Yes. That's right. It's just two columns. Both.
Both just say twats on them.
I mean, I've got so many directors here. Stanley Kubrick. Do you want to know what his 13th movie was as director?
Go on.
His final movie as director.
Oh.
Really?
Yeah. Eyes Wide Shut.
Fidelio.
Alfred Hitchcock. His 13th movie was a silent movie. It was an adaptation of the Irish play Juno and the Peacock.
Oh, God, I hated that play. I'm assuming the film is terrible.
Yes, I haven't seen it. I'm sorry, Hitchcockians, Hitchcock fans, Hitchcockers, Hitchcockicidal maniacs, whatever it is you call yourselves, you know, I'm sorry that we haven't seen Juno and the Peacock.
Yes, I apologize, but also,
yeah. Yeah, it's a double cock, though, so maybe that's good. Oh, but Danny Boyle.
What about him?
Yesterday.
Yeah.
Okay. Guillermo del Toro?
Oh, yeah.
Frankenstein.
Ooh.
No. Yeah.
Not better than The Odyssey.
James doesn't like that.
Absolutely not.
James, any more you want to throw at me? Any more? Because I looked it up, like, you know, I was trying to think of people, action directors you would like. But John McTiernan hasn't made 13
movies. I was going to say, I don't think he's made 13 movies.
Yeah.
How many has Jan de Bont made?
Thankfully, not 13.
Yeah.
What about Renly Harlin? John Landis, we're talking about great action, great directors from the 1980s. John Landis's 13th movie was Beverly Hills Cop 3, famously one of the worst movies.
It's a winner.
I mean, it really is. This is just a litany of disasters and unfortunate movies. But I think I found the winner.
Okay.
Do you want to know the winner?
Please.
I want to hear it.
The winner, in my opinion, is a movie that I think could be considered to be better than The Odyssey. It is a movie that came out in the 1960s. It is a movie that was made by a British director.
Oh, is it David Lean?
And that director was David Lean. And the movie is even longer than The Odyssey.
Whoa.
Lawrence of Arabia.
Okay. I mean, we can't really argue with Lawrence of Arabia, can we?
Well,
you can do. He's dead. He can argue that.
No, but like, come on. This is the movie that Steven Spielberg watches every time he makes a new film. Like, it's, yeah.
Doesn't show.
You can't really argue with it.
Is this why it takes him so long to make movies?
It doesn't, though. That's the thing, isn't it? He's quite productive, actually. Anyway.
I mean, look, yeah. I'm not saying it's not the best movie set or filmed in the Wadi Rum, but because Dune's part one and part two are clearly superior.
The Martian.
And yes, I was thinking of The Martian.
And one of the Star Wars.
Yeah.
Which one?
Poe Dameron was in a speeder with Finn and they were going across the desert with some other people fighting. And then the stormtroopers fly now.
The Force Awakens, right?
No.
It might have been Rise of Skywalker.
Good movie, Ben Travis.
I think that's it was Rise of Skywalker. Because I think Oscar Isaac was there basically for two different films in the same year.
Huh.
Anyway, the Wadi Rum's been in everything.
All right, okay. So, okay, I'm gonna
the Wadi Rum gone?
I think that, oh, Jesus Christ. I don't know why King Charles III just popped into the pod booth. What the fuck was that? All right, I'm going to very, very quickly expand this question.
Okay.
Let's take franchises that have 13 or more installments.
Jesus.
And see whether their 13th installment is better or worse than The Odyssey. So James Bond.
Uh-huh.
All right. So the 13th James Bond movie, and I haven't written this down, so I don't know. Off the top of my head, I believe it is Octopussy. So is Helen.
Yes,
I put it to you.
I put it to you that it is.
I put it to you. Is Octopussy better or worse than Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey?
It's worse.
Are you sure about that? You said that very, very quickly.
Yeah, I did.
Jimbo, is it better or worse than The Odyssey?
It is regrettably worse than The Odyssey. The Odyssey. But it does have Fabergé eggs in it, so it goes
away. It does have Fabergé eggs, and a bit where Bond dresses up as a clown.
That's right, and he is funny. The 13th Star Trek is Star Trek Beyond.
Better or worse than The Odyssey?
It's worse than The Odyssey, James.
I refuse to answer on the grounds my answer may incriminate me.
I would say The Odyssey has a lot of things going for it. It does not have beats or shouting. Actually, it does have both.
It does, but it doesn't have Sabotage by the Beastie Boys.
No, that's true. I put it to you. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's the one thing we have going for it. Star Wars? Have we hit 13 in Star Wars yet?
Good. So we got 9, 10...
8, technically, but yes. 9 plus Rogue One plus Solo plus The Mandalorian and Grogu. So we're not actually
at
13.
Not there yet. No. Do we count, to play for.
Well, do we count Battlefriend or Battle?
No.
Battlefriend or
Caravan of Courage.
No? Okay. All right. So MCU.
I'm not sure I count The Mandalorian
Captain
and Grogu.
Captain America Civil War, I believe.
Is that the 13th?
Is it?
I just did a quick look and I think that's
it's
the 13th.
It's definitely better than The Odyssey.
Many of the same people.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, genuinely, but it's
one
great.
Of the same
it's
people.
Great. Is it better than The Odyssey? I tell you this, if I had to watch one of those films, it wouldn't be The Odyssey.
I can't answer this question.
No, that's fair. I know. You're just too torn.
That's fair.
I'm too torn.
Yeah.
It's
a choice.
You're like Natalie Imbruglia.
Do I watch Captain America Civil War again? Or do I watch Captain America Civil War again? It's such a toughie. But there you go. And I think that's pretty much it, right?
There's
probably a couple of probably a couple of hit 13, but I don't even know what the 13th Carry On was. Carry On, look at my boobs.
Yes. I believe that's what it's called. Yeah. Yes.
Actually, I know a lot of people who would go see Carry On, Look at My Boobs.
I would ride Carry On, Look at My Boobs.
I'm surprised you haven't already.
I've just finished. It's done. That's actually a line from the film.
It's
was that hang on
carry on
that,
don't
was, that was either Barbossa
head.
Or Sid James. I couldn't really tell.
That was King Charles III playing Sid James.
I think it was Carry On, Don't Lose Your Head.
That's a good one.
Yeah, but it's grammatically upsetting.
Yeah. Carry On, Don't Lose Your Head.
Yeah, there's no comma, though.
Oh, fuck off. Right, so if you want to have your question read out on the Emperor Podcast, you can do so by getting in touch with me on Instagram, or you can slide in my DMs on Blue Sky or Twitter, where I am still lurking to this day. And if the question's good enough, we will read it out. We may not read out your name. That may get lost in the shuffle.
Oh, gosh.
But we'll try and correct that in a future episode. Not next week, though, because I'm not here.
You're not here?
I'm not here next week. So it'll be the week after that we give the person who asked that question their due credit. All right, should we have a little break?
Let's.
And then we'll come back and we'll talk about what passes for movie news. Enjoy. We are back, folks. We are back, and it's time to dig deep into the world of movie news. There's not a lot, I'll be honest, but something did seem to break just before we started recording Hell's Bells.
We were just talking about an article about Barbie 2.
Right.
And the word is that they are having trouble, that Warner Brothers are having trouble making a deal because they didn't want to give the cast and crew that much more money, or certainly as much more money as the cast and crew felt was appropriate. And they have so far failed to close a deal. And there is a bit of a ticking clock on this, because if they don't do it within a certain amount of time, the rights revert back to the toy company. So they kind of have to get a shimmy on. And apparently there were no clauses for, first look options and so on for the sequel. So even though Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach have an idea, have a concept, have a plan for the Barbie 2 script, David Zaslav and the Warner Brothers team have failed to close a deal for them to make it, which is pretty crazy. I will say This is more common with female-led films than it maybe should be. So if you remember, there was quite a long time before the second Wonder Woman with Patty Jenkins returning was greenlit, because they didn't really want to give her an uplift.
They may have also read the script, to be fair.
But they didn't know at that point it was going to be Wonder Woman 1984. Oh, okay. But they just didn't give her the kind of uplift that is absolutely standard in male contracts and is almost not even questioned, right? It doesn't seem to happen. There were stories of this all the way back to the first Wives Club. Those three women took a pay cut to get that film made, because the studio were like, look, this is an untried concept. These women in their 40s and 50s doing this film, like, we don't know if anyone's going to go see it. We can't pay you all like leading lady fees. So they took a pay cut. It was a massive hit. And then the studio wanted them to do the sequel for the same pay cut. And this is the kind of thing that keeps happening again and again in female-led films.
The same pay
films.
Cut or the same pay rate?
The same pay rate as the, you know, okay. the same cut rate of pay.
Okay.
And this is the kind of thing that keeps happening again and again. And it's not great that it's happening to Barbie, a bona fide smash hit that won a bunch of Oscar nominations and indeed Oscars. But anyway, apparently that's the holdup in announcing Barbie 2. If they can't reach a deal, they will have to completely reboot from scratch. They can't use any of the sort of concepts and sort of spin that Greta Gerwig brought to it, as my understanding in the article. So that's going to be interesting. That was in Variety.
I'm not sure it's a bad thing that we don't get a second Barbie. I mean, to be fair, they could do something really interesting with it. My worry would be is that Barbie is so, it's such a good film. It's so well executed. It's such a great, spin on that idea. It's my pissing in the pool thing. I almost don't want it to be sullied by an inferior sequel. I maybe would rather it be one and done.
Uh-huh.
What if they'd said the same about Bond back in 1962 or whatever?
Alien. We'd never have had Octopussy, which, as we've agreed, is better than The Odyssey.
Yeah. If James Cameron had gone into that room and started writing Alien on the board, then did his little thing with the S and the dollar sign, and they went, sorry, mate, we're good. One and done.
One and done.
Yeah.
That's our motto here at 20th Century Fox.
Don't piss in our pool.
Yeah. Why is he pissing in our pool anyway? Why do we have a pool in the middle of this meeting room? This is such a weird layout.
This is where they spend all their money.
Yeah. Think, James, think.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, we would be in a better world now if Patty Jenkins had not made Wonder Woman 84. So.
Yeah, but you can say that about loads of directors who were automatically given a pay lift for the sequel.
Would we be in a better world?
Oh, definitely.
Has your life been affected negatively by the existence of Wonder Woman 1984?
Yes, I watched it.
Okay.
Mm.
Right. And those 2 hours you would have spent so productively.
100%, yes.
Yeah.
But look, a sequel, more of a good thing is a good thing, right? Like, if you can do that, if you can continue something and make it better, then great. And certain films feel like they lend themselves to sequels more than others. I just think Barbie exists as a really, really nice self-contained thing. I don't think it's screaming out for a continuation of the story beyond its ability to make lots of money, personally.
Interestingly, I've just read that Chris Nolan, Emma Thomas, Emily Blunt, and Cillian Murphy have also not closed their deals for Oppenheimer 2. So
Oppenheimer's.
Yeah.
So we're denied Barbenheimer 2.
It's such a shame. It'd be amazing. I would genuinely love if they do make a Barbie 2 that Chris Nolan has to make Oppenheimer 2 and it has to come out the same day.
It's Barbie, contractual. Two-heimer.
Mm. Yes. Yes, two Barbie, two-heimer. All right.
Christopher Nolan, though, is having a relatively good week because The Odyssey has passed the billion mark. It's, I think, 1.12 at this stage. Mm-hmm. So it's his highest grossing film.
Yay. A long time after his last billion-dollar grosser, which you kind of forget how long it's been.
What was his last billion?
Dark Knight Rises.
Was it?
Yeah. But it's really, really good to see that just because it means, this one really broke through. And also, it changes the worldwide chart for this year and knocks some films I didn't like down a little bit. So Michael and Super Mario Galaxy are now, falling down behind The Odyssey, Toy Story 5, and of course, Spider-Man Brand New Day at the top.
There's $5 billion grocers so far this year, isn't
yeah,
there?
Yeah, yeah. It's
which is interesting. And you'd assume that Doomsday will become the 6th. And there's a chance that Dune Part 3 might become the 7th, although I don't think it will.
I don't think it will. I hope it does, but I don't think it will.
I mean, I think Project Hail Mary was, 680-something? Dune 3 is probably around similar numbers.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah.
Where do you think Brand New Day will end up?
So Brand New Day at the moment is 1.7 billion.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
And is...
That's 10 days in, I guess.
10 days in. It's. I think it's going to end up around 2.25. Yeah. That's what I'm going to say. But that is just a wild fucking guess.
Isn't it?
So it might well become, one of the three biggest films of all time? Possibly. You just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of amazing that we're in this situation. If it hits 2.5, it'll become the third biggest film of all time. So I think that's kind of where it's got to be looking, right?
Yeah, fingers crossed.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I really enjoyed, I wasn't on when we reviewed that, I really enjoyed the film, but it's not even the best Tom Holland Spider-Man film, so it is kind of nuts that it's making this.
A lot of people
money.
Think it is, though. I know a lot of people. They're maybe not in this room.
Many, many fine people.
And I like the movie a lot, but I know a lot of people who think it's the best one. For me, it is not the best one, but it's a very, very good.
Very good film.
Very good. Very good film. Very good Spider-Man film. Very good MCU film. Ticks a lot of boxes. And clearly, I honestly, the success of this movie is really, really interesting to me. Like, where has it come from?
Yeah.
Given that last year Marvel were basically were in a sandwich board going, come and please see the Thunderbolts.
I mean,
look, we'll put the Avengers in the title. Would that help? Would that help? It's a really good film. You should come and see the Thunderbolts.
Please, sir, can I have another $500 million? Yes. I've only made just under $500 million and it's not enough.
There'll be people watching Spider-Man Brand New Day who will be seeing, oh, that's a spoiler, a character from the Thunderbolts movie for the first time.
Yes.
And they'll be going, who is this character from that movie? And they'll have to go back. Yeah. And then they'll go, oh man, I should have seen the Thunderbolts movie when it came out last year.
Well, I'm very pleased for Marvel, who get to sit back and watch Sony rake in all this money. So
they get a little bit.
They get a little kickback.
They get a little taste. A little taste as well. But Sony are doing very, very well. Very, very well indeed. What if it's became the highest grossing MCU movie?
I mean,
it's a chance.
It's got a chance.
Why can't it do?
I just, it would upset me.
Just for that, I'm going to see it 500 more times.
I bet you will.
We're going to push it over the edge. Mm. Avengers Endgame is just shy of 2.8 billion. This is tricky because Avengers Endgame is being re-released next month in September as Endgame Encore.
Mm.
Now, the very fact it's called Endgame Encore, it has a little bit more footage. So they can't add its takings to Avengers Endgame. So this isn't like a diddle.
Yeah, I was about to say, what are the rules on that? Because lots of re-releases do contribute to the overall box office. Is it changing the title? Is it changing?
Well, the title has changed. Yeah, it's not even Avengers Endgame Encore. It's just Endgame Encore.
Why have they done that?
I don't know why. I don't know. Well, that's what the trailer was. Certainly the one they showed at Comic-Con.
Because I wonder if... Because I would feel, if I were doing it, I would try and add a little bit of cumulative gross to the overall thing to push my numbers up.
Yeah, try and get it above Avatar again.
Right. You and know, it's not of... like films have not released different cuts and done that, so...
Yeah. I don't know.
We shall see.
We shall see if Endgame suddenly leaps above Avatar, but would have to make another 140 million.
It's not beyond the realm of possibility.
I mean, it's been a while. People might go back and see it on the big screen.
I can't wait to go back and see it in the cinema, so...
It's very, very exciting.
I saw it one or two or nine times when it came out, but I'll probably see it again.
All right.
Nine times.
Okie dokie. Anything else you want to talk about in the world of movie news?
There was a trailer for Paper Tiger this week, which is the new James Gray film, with Adam Driver and Miles Teller playing brothers, Gary and Irwin, with Scarlett Johansson as Irwin's wife, Hester. So she's married to Miles Teller in this. We don't have to worry about her getting divorced from Adam Driver again.
So it's Black Widow. Reed God. Richards and the man who probably turned down Reed Richards.
Yes, they are together again at last. The idea is that basically the brothers got involved in a scheme that was too good to be true. I think Adam Driver seems to be running for maybe mayor of New York, or is mayor of New York.
Okay,
I only watched the trailer once. And,
okay, good.
And now they're in trouble with the Russian mob who are targeting them. And Adam Driver's all like, don't worry, it's fine. I'm the mayor, they can't touch me. And Miles Teller's like, I'm not the mayor, they can touch me. What the fuck? So, yeah.
Well, I'm sure it'll all have a happy ending. And as all James Gray movies do, it always works out. For the protagonist.
Yeah.
They just have the best time.
So good.
The best time.
So cozy.
We are recording this podcast before D23 probably kicks off. Our Ben Travis is going out to Anaheim to witness it firsthand.
He's on a plane right now.
Can't help but feeling that the leaked X-Men casting rumors will be confirmed officially on stage at some point during D23.
You think?
It seems likely at this point because they're leaking like a sieve at the moment.
Okay, so leak, James. This is an unfortunate sentence, but leak over me, James. What are the leaks?
Samara Weaving. Yes. Is linked with Emma Frost at the moment.
That.
Kit Connors is obviously linked with Cyclops as well.
Connor, yeah.
There is another from Heartbreaker, Heartstopper. God, I'm miss saying everything at the moment. Miss saying? Is that even a word? I don't know. What is happening?
Should we start the podcast again?
Yeah, let's do it again.
All right.
Bangley Bang.
The Empire podcast this week. He's back for the second time in just a few weeks.
What have we had for lunch? We haven't had a Bodine's. What's Bodine's? Well... You should have a Soho special. Something to do with Five Guys, lots of sex jokes, the end.
Yes.
Right.
The 13th movie by a director.
Oh,
I think it's Lawrence of Arabia, guys, but it might be Captain America Civil War.
What was the 13th Soho special you ate? I don't know.
I don't know.
It was
probably
a long time
ago. It was probably the first week I had a Soho special because honestly, guys, you do not understand how good these things were. It was incredible.
I feel like we could move back to where we were.
Back to where we were? Yeah. All right.
Kit Connor.
Maybe Cyclops.
Yes, he may
Indy
be Cyclops.
Indy Navarrete from, and that's probably a weird way to pronounce that name, from Obsession, might be Mystique.
Yeah.
And Samara Weaving might be Emma Frost. This is an there's...
Was it Tom Pelfrey as well, potentially?
Oh, I haven't seen this one.
As Professor X?
Who the fuck is that?
Professor X is...
he's bald. He's psychic.
I know who Professor X is.
Thank God for that.
Who is Tom Pelfrey?
Tom Pelfrey most recently was in Task with Mark Ruffalo, set in the Mayor of Easttown universe. He's really, really good. And yes, he was in the latter seasons of My Beloved Banshee, Jonathan Tropper's show. He's very good. He's really, really good in Task.
I would have thought they'd gone for a big name for Professor X. Although they're saying that Christopher Abbott might also be in the running for that.
Who knows?
He's a slightly bigger name. Even then, like not super big.
He doesn't strike me as the sort of guy. I've interviewed Christopher Abbott. Obviously, he was in The Wolfman, but he doesn't strike me as the sort of guy who will embrace franchises.
I think
necessarily.
I think that's probably fair. It's interesting. Look, they're clearly skewing younger, which I think is the right way to go. I think Kit Connor's a really interesting Cyclops because he's so likable in Heartstopper. I think he's got a really solid, you know, centered kind of energy, which I think would be quite good for that role.
I mean, a lot of this stuff obviously is still rumored. It hasn't been officially confirmed, but I can't help feeling that they are going to do it. And it feels like D23 is the time and place to do it.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
So I mean, I'm very excited about this.
Yeah.
You know, even if you're a Marvel skeptic at the moment, even if you do feel that it's a little bit lost its way, the X-Men is exciting. And it seems like they're going for a very young generation of X-Men, which is, I think, definitely the way to 100%. Go as well. Because I also think you want to distance yourself from... It's going to be weird seeing a young Logan. That's going to be strange.
I don't think. I don't necessarily know that he'll be young. Logan doesn't have to be young.
No, he doesn't.
Logan could be middle-aged.
Yeah.
And you also don't need to bring him in the first wave.
I think you do. I kind of think you do because he's... I mean, I think you're right in that we're not that far away from Deadpool and Wolverine. Like, Hugh Jackman is Wolverine, so it's a really hard thing to do. And especially if you don't go young, then you're putting someone up against Hugh Jackman. And that's a difficult thing to do.
I also wouldn't be surprised if Hugh Jackman's in Secret Wars. So I don't think that they'll have a Wolverine in this movie yet.
It's hard to imagine an X-Men story without Wolverine. I know, obviously, there are many, many wonderful X-Men.
Yes.
But Wolverine is the best.
I agree, but I still think they're not going to have him in this one.
And that may be a sound tactical decision on their part. Yeah, no. I would say. But I can't think how, because Hugh Jackman is so synonymous with that role. I don't know how you move on from that.
Yeah, it's going to be tricky. Maybe they don't do it in this movie. Maybe they do it in the next movie. Yeah.
Maybe that's the Christopher Abbott role.
Maybe. Yeah.
He'd be more of a Wolverine than a Professor X in my head canon.
Obviously, we have not seen these people's screen tests. We haven't seen their chemistry tests. Yeah. I'm sure this Tom Pelfrey
Again, rumor. It was rumored on a podcast, so I mean, that could be nonsense.
No, but yeah, I'm seeing it on lots of news here as well. I'm sure he's been balled up for screen tests and all sorts of stuff. And I mean, we shall see. It's going to be very, very interesting, the makeup of these characters. So, you know, Mystique, Emma Frost, these are potential bad guys. I'm reading Adam Driver maybe in the mix, finally, to make a Marvel movie, but as a bad guy. And what will the team be? So if it is Cyclops and it is potentially, I don't know if there's a Jean Grey in the mix at some point, is it going to be the classic X-Men team that started off in the comics? So is it going to be that five? Is it going to be Cyclops and Beast and Jean Grey and Angel and Iceman? Is that what it's going to be?
It could be something like that.
It could be. Or are they going to throw in a Nightcrawler? Are they going to throw in a Storm? There's rumors that Storm...
There's been rumors about both of those, haven't there?
Yeah, rumors that Storm's going to be in Black Panther 3.
Well, you've also got to think about the fact that this isn't like we're doing an X-Men movie. It's like we're beginning an X-Men chapter of this universe. And they do want to keep their powder dry, don't they? Like, they've got so many great characters. You probably don't want to drop them all at the beginning. You do want to pace yourself and you want different stories with different characters and different textures. They are probably kind of like portioning them all out and working how these things will fit together. That's very exciting.
Yeah.
How's it going to work? So we have the X-Men. We have an X-Men team in Doomsday. I'm sure there'll be an X-Men team in Secret Wars. It may even be this X-Men team, but it seems to me like they are going to set up in this MCU world, they're going to set up the fact that Charles Xavier is already in this world. We just haven't become aware of him. And he's been slowly recruiting people, you know, kids for his school for gifted youngsters. And Cyclops, Scott Summers may be one of them, and Jean Grey may be another. And we get there and there's Beast and there's Warren Worthington and all those guys. But how the other X-Men team from Doomsday fits into it. The classic.
Yeah. The Fox team.
Yeah, the Fox team. Mm. The Marsdens and the Cummings and the Romains. Yeah, that's going to be interesting. I don't know how that's going to work out.
Because it works in Deadpool Wolverine because it's not really part of the main playing board. But yeah, this brings it all into direct canon rather than canon adjacency. Yeah.
But I still think that...
But it's all multiversal, isn't it?
So. Yeah. And I think as a result, Jackman might be in Secret Wars.
I can see that. Yeah. I'm talking about new Wolverines, I don't think.
Yeah.
But we shall see.
How they get there, it's not our job to figure that one out. That that is for the Russos and Steve McFeely to figure out. So good luck, guys. Good luck with that one. And of course, Jack Schreier, who's directing this movie.
Indeed.
This X-Men movie. Yeah. So we shall see what happens. They are making a sequel to Jurassic World, nearly said Park, Jurassic World Rebirth, but not with Gareth Edwards, who has dropped out.
I heard they couldn't afford him anymore after the jolly they sent James on last time.
It's true. Yeah, most of the budget went on my trip to Thailand.
You laugh, but it's probably true.
Yeah.
So what did we make of this? First of all, I didn't know that this was happening. So it was a surprise to me when I read that he had dropped out of a film I didn't know existed.
Yeah, so it's apparently creative differences but we don't know what that means. That can mean anything from they want me to go faster than I'm comfortable with. The script is still three notes on a cocktail napkin with a question mark next to them. Or it could mean they want to have dinosaurs fighting flying fighter jets and I just can't figure out a way to do that creatively, or anything in between. You know, it's always a very kind of slippery thing. Or it may literally just be, I don't vibe with this. I don't feel where they're going.
So, I think that's probably it. I mean, just having interviewed Gareth about it, like, don't get me wrong, he was so excited at the opportunity to make a Jurassic Park film. Like, it's a dream for him. And I think he actually had a good experience doing it, unlike, say, you know, Star Wars. But equally, beyond getting paid a lot of money, because, you know, Rebirth did well, I do wonder whether he'd actually rather go off and do something else. I interviewed him. I saw him in Thailand. It was his last ever interview for Rebirth before he was going off to work on other projects. And he was so excited at the prospect of just flying home and just on the plane, just getting out a blank pad and just noodling ideas, you know. And I think, you know, when the creator, I think, was a mixed blessing for him, because obviously it didn't do that well and it was difficult, but it was a great film. And honestly, I would like to see Gareth do more films like that, like original films, like wild ideas, just run amok, because that was such a great film and it should have done a lot better than it did. So weirdly for him, I think this is good news. For Jurassic, maybe less so, because I actually think he's really good. But yeah, I'm really interested to see what he does next.
Yeah, 100%, absolutely. And also interested to see who they get in for this. And I, you know, dinosaurs with fighter jets, I think it could work.
Yeah.
Guys, just call me.
Yeah, I'll sounds good.
It. I don't care.
And where's Storm and Wolverine fit into this? Where do they?
Yeah, they're definitely going to be there.
Yeah, they'll call it. They call it Jurassic World: The Savage Land.
Oh my god! I kind of.
that would be kind of amazing. Oh dear.
How many X-Men movies do we have to have before we can go to the Savage Land? Do we think?
Oh, hang on. What's the 13th X-Men movie?
Have there
been 13?
Oh yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm going to get increasingly high pitched.
We did a ranking. There was about 14 or 15.
Oh, because you're including, like, okay, the spin-offy typey things.
So you get the three initial X-Men movies.
Yes.
Then there's the four of those.
Yeah.
Then there's two Deadpools. Then
two Wolverines.
Three Wolverines.
Jesus.
Yeah, so we're already up to 13. New Mutants? Everyone. How could you possibly forget that?
Well, the 13th apparently was the New Mutants.
Oh, that's not it.
Is it better than the Odyssey?
I don't think it's better than the Odyssey, no. Yeah. But it's interesting, isn't it? The makeup of the X-Men team. If it is the classic X-Men team, thank God that Jean Grey is there. Because you know what, Helen?
Yeah.
Otherwise, that'd be five guys.
Oh, boy.
We're back to the Soho special.
Yeah, we are.
The reason I say that is because this week's guest has directed a movie called Tony, which is not a biopic, but a snapshot of the younger Anthony Bourdain, the brilliant food writer and cook, who, of course, passed away a few years ago. This is based on his early years.
Yeah, he's kind of learning stuff, but despite himself. He goes to Cape Cod for the summer, basically following a girl, and gets a job in a kitchen just to keep himself afloat, and then does everything wrong and is a general disaster of a human being. But,
Sounds good.
Maybe there's the nugget of someone great within him.
A great cook, a great writer, a great mind.
Indeed.
At work there. And the movie is, of course, Tony. He is played in the film by Dominic Sessa. He's terrific, isn't
he?
I mean, I haven't seen that film, but I would be amazed if he's not brilliant in it. And the director is, of course, Matt Johnson, who just a couple of weeks ago directed James's favorite film of the year, Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie. Director also of Blackberry, and just a real live wire of a director. And we sent on Zoom, I think it was, Amon Warman to have a chat with him a couple of weeks ago. So here now is that chat. Do please enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by the director of Tony, Mr. Matt Johnson. How are you, sir?
I'm wonderful. I've been on this podcast for Empire before, haven't I?
I think so, for Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Empire's cool. Nice to meet you. Yeah.
Nice to meet you. And yes, you are the director of that film as well, which made our list of the best films released in the UK this year so far. Very well deserved. I watched it recently, had a great time.
Thank
when
you.
Did you start to realize that people were really connecting with that movie. And what have the last few months been like for you as you see more and more people seek out that movie and connect with it?
I got to be honest, it's been quite strange because, you know, I live in Toronto in Canada, and we'd been making that show for 20 years. And to see the explosion in popularity that's happened just in the last 6 months has been surreal, to say the least. But I've just been grateful. It's deeply humbling that people like that. I mean, it's a group of less than 10 friends who make it. And in some ways, it's like a little private secret. And so it has an outsized reaction based on what we thought it would be.
Yeah, it is secret no more. And thank you for sharing that with us again. It's a really, really fun film, as is Tony. I had a really, really good time watching this. I guess the first place to start with this is, what was your relationship to Anthony Bourdain before this movie?
A great question. And the answer, I think, is maybe surprising to a lot of people, but none. I barely even knew who he was. Like, wow. I obviously knew him as a cultural figure, but I would say no more than I would have known. Like, I knew Gordon Ramsay better, you know. Wow. So I didn't have, I would say the best way of putting this is, I didn't have any baggage. The worst way is to say I was totally ignorant. But I like making movies about things that I know nothing about, because it allows me to operate from the point of view of an audience and get curious about what exactly it is that is relevant or cool or demanding of interest of this person or this thing or this process or whatever. Like, I made a movie about the first smartphone called BlackBerry, and I know nothing about that world at all. But I view it as a strength as opposed to a weakness, because, yeah, it's just there's something that I think audiences want to see. They want to see things from the point of view of a newcomer to that, as opposed to an expert, because to become an expert at something, you kind of need to know everything, and you have to present a point of view that's unassailable. Whereas what I'm trying to do is tell a story that is in some ways universal.
Yeah. That's so interesting to me, because you're also a co-writer on this movie, and this film was based in part on Kitchen Confidential, Anthony Bourdain's book. How did you zero in on the period of Bourdain's life to show in this film? Because I think that's one of the major strengths of this film in doing that, because you, I think, in doing that, avoid some biopic tropes that you could have maybe otherwise fallen into.
It's a great point and a great question. And I felt like I understood what it was like to be a young man trying to prove himself desperately. And I thought I had something to say about that. And when I met Dominic Sessa, I saw that he was going through this exact same thing at this time in his life. And I thought, this is such a great marriage of me having just gone through this myself and him going through it now, and Anthony Bourdain having gone through it in the 1970s. And the three of us can conspire to tell a story about what it means to be a young man becoming an adult and how painful that can be. And some of the traps you can fall for. And so that was our goal. Like, let's make a movie about just that.
Mm. And when you cast Dominic Sessa, who is fantastic in this, just as he was in The Holdovers, are you telling him to seek out stuff related to Anthony Bourdain, or are you telling him not to do that?
I told him, I said, don't touch a thing. Literally. I told him not to do anything. Now, of course, I wanted him to be comfortable in kitchens. I wanted him to have I gave him a copy of Kitchen Confidential and a few other things that Bourdain had written about this time in his life, which he read. I introduced him to a lot of people that knew Anthony at this time, but he had it. Like, he was ready. I met him in New York City, and this is when I wasn't planning on making this movie. And within an hour, I was like, okay, I am going to make this movie. I'm going to make it about Dominic Sessa, and we're ready to go right now. Like, let's start shooting tomorrow, because he just had it.
Also great in this is Antonio Banderas as chef. The first thing I got to ask you that is, approximately how many times did Antonio drenched Dominic in water, and how much did he enjoy that?
Yeah, you know what? Credit to Banderas. He didn't enjoy it at all.
Oh,
credit to Banderas. Like he was so worried about how uncomfortable and terrible it was going to be to splash Dom over and over and over again. And sure, he makes it look like he's having a good time, but no, yeah, I mean, that was a partnership. That was a partnership. Mm. That was one of the harder things to film because we had to do it like 25, 30 times.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. I just, his character and the way that he relates to Tony, I think is just great. He is the guy who helps Tony find his purpose and hone his skills. Who helped you hone your passion as you were first starting out?
It's such a great question. I, in some ways, I made this movie to honor those people because I myself get so much credit for oddly being myself, right? As any filmmaker does, it's like, wow, look at you. And I'm so in debt to the people who made me that I wanted to make a film to recognize that. So look, I didn't have a mentor in the sense that Tony does with Antonio Banderas, being both a kind of an almost religious figure in his life, but also extremely stern. But he is an extension of Bourdain's own mother, who has standards for him, and played by Dagmara, who and want something better for him. And that is taken right from my own life. My mom was a major role model for me, and in a way that I found very intimidating and tried to get out from under, right? I think my whole history of being such a liar comes from me trying to elude the standards that that my mom set for me. And so a lot of that is both in Anthony Bourdain and Dagmara. But then I also had incredible role models at summer camp with camp counselors who were older men that I looked up to as though they were superheroes. I was like, how can anyone be this funny? How can they be so confident? Like this, it was blowing my mind when I was young that this behavior was even available to me. And then even in film school, just the other night, I was having dinner with a friend who in many ways created me. I'm still doing an impression of him, if you can believe it. And no one will ever know. No one will ever know. Mm-hmm. People are going to think, wow, that Matt Johnson is really one of a kind. it couldn't be further from the truth. And although I am extrapolating, I like to think that Anthony Bourdain is not immune to that, and that we all owe the people who helped to create us. And that's beautiful. And I think that that's a healthy message for young people to take, which is that you look for role models, look to where your interests go. Why are you interested in this person? Right? Like pursue that. Like that's something in you, that there's a small voice in your head that's saying, this person interests you. Follow that. What is it about them that you like? Because they are going to wind up making you. And so don't take it lightly.
One thing I'm a big nerd for film scores and soundtracks, and the soundtrack to this one is just great. I'm excited to listen to it properly on this lens. So there's so many great tracks. But for you, what is the secret to a good needle drop? And was anything that you had trouble securing the rights to?
Well, these songs were extremely expensive, but thank God I'm making this movie for A24. It was the first time where I was making a film for a studio that was paying for it. That has never happened to me before in my life. A needle drop to me needs to match the behavior and the feeling of a scene so perfectly that everybody in the audience goes, like, almost takes a breath. Like there's, and when you get it right, there's, in my opinion, there's really nothing like it. I think that film is the one medium. I suppose dance is actually similar, but for me, film is the place where music can highlight images like nothing else. And so every chance I can, I take it to do so.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think there's ever a bad time for a fifth of Beethoven, and you best believe I was bopping my head to that one.
I'm so happy you like that. That's my my editor Kurt Lobb is wholly responsible for that.
Oh,
and he won me over with that song. Yeah, it was amazing.
It fits that montage so perfectly as well. One of my favorite sequences in the film. You had a great quote on the feature for this film where you said, "Bourdain's life shows you that you can learn so much from your failures that it helps create you."
Yes.
And you've been a filmmaker since 2013. You made many great films. What's the most valuable lesson failure has taught you?
Oh, I fail every one of my films. I fail. Do I learn from them? I don't know. But I would say the meta lesson is you just never give up on the project. Like I've had movies that have been complete and total disasters that I just refuse to close the casket on, because movies are funny because it's a temporal medium. And so you don't know. I mean, look at the Nirvana the Band movie as an example. We shot that web series and it was kind of an abysmal failure. And lo and behold, 20 years later, I'm using the footage from that web series to create a movie where we travel in time between the present and the past solely because of that failed web series. And yet at the same time, I learned so much making that web series that allowed me to then create the movie. It's such a crazy back and forth relationship. So look, I would say that's the meta lesson. Something more specific, have the actors say less. What I'm doing in my edit is almost always cutting out my stupid dialogue and just playing on the faces of the actors, which are so much more interesting. I try to do that more and more as I get older. Oh God. Yeah. I mean, I failed so badly. and to remember that tomorrow's another day, that just going to sleep and not thinking that's it, it's over for me. My life is done and I suck. Like going to bed and realizing that tomorrow you get to go again. But yeah. I also don't want to give the advice not to get wrapped up emotionally in your work, because I think that's what gives it its power. And I wouldn't get so despondent around my failures if I didn't believe that what I was doing mattered. So yeah, look, advice is a complicated game, and I try not to get into it, because what worked for me will likely not work for everybody, and I'm also a fool.
One thing I did enjoy with this film, the drive-in theater sequence.
Oh yeah, I love it.
You had Jaws playing. Did you and the cast get to watch the full thing? Did you have a chance with?
I got good news and bad news. Good news and bad news there, and that is that because when you're shooting a movie, there was a very specific scene I wanted to play on the screen. And so I needed to have my designer loop that sequence over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. And so we did get to watch a section of Jaws, but we had to watch it again and again and again and again and again and again and again. And it was only one 10-minute section. So we didn't get to string it up and play the whole thing from the beginning. But that's a very famous drive-in theater. It's called the Wellfleet Drive-In. And it's where Jaws famously played an entire summer in 1975, because that was the spot.
Amazing. Amazing. I've never had the pleasure of a drive-in theater. I want to experience it at least once in my lifetime, but
awesome.
Yeah. Okay, sure. And I believe that is our time. Matt Johnson, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure. Congratulations on the film.
You have a great day.
Okay, that was Matt Johnson talking to Amon Warman about Tony, and Tony is out in cinemas right now, folks, and we're going to talk about it right now because it is time for the reviews section of the show. Before we get into Tony, though, I will say, don't forget Nimrods, a Green Day comedy, opened on Tuesday of this week. We gave it 3 stars, but I think it's a really, really sweet, quite funny coming-of-age comedy with some great music, especially, of course, if you are into Green Day. So do check that out. And an interview with Mason Temes and the director Lee Kirk is available on this week's episode of The Interviews, which is going to be up very, very soon. Also featuring Adam Shankman, who is the director of next week's comedy Stop That Train! So that is very, very exciting. And on next week's interviews, we have the two drag queen stars of that movie.
Amazing.
Jujubee and Ginger Minge. That was a joyous interview to do, by the way. So yes, looking forward to that. But if you are sick and tired of seeing The Odyssey and Spider-Man Brand New Day and Nimrod's A Green Day Comedy, and you're looking for something else to see, well, this week we got you covered, haven't we? Who wants to take Tony?
This is, as we said, Matt Johnson on the story of Anthony Bourdain's early years as Tony. He is a student of Vassar who, when we meet him, is essentially pitching his wildly pretentious novel idea to a literary fellowship board, trying to get money to basically sit and write the great American novel that summer. They see right through him and turn him down, and he ends up basically going to Cape Cod in pursuit of a woman, Nancy, played by Emilia Jones, and ends up kind of, to keep himself afloat, taking a job in a kitchen. And it's Antonio Banderas' kitchen. He's just known as Chef, basically, in this movie.
Chef.
And he's kind of horrified by what he sees, but also kind of intrigued. He kind of finds a little bit of an almost mentor relationship eventually with Chef. Has a bit more of, it's kind of a good angel on one shoulder, bad angel on the other shoulder, Leah Woodall being the bad angel, who's basically taking him out to get fucked up every night and shag ladies and generally
living. Oh no, this sounds terrible.
I know, you must be shocked. Please avert your ears. No, Chris.
This is outrageous. Where do I sign?
I tell you what's great about this. Like, Dominic Sessa, first of all, belongs in 70s set movies. Like, he's so good in The Holdovers. He's so incredible here.
It's the sideburns.
He is, but he's also just incredibly good at playing these characters who are objectively privileged, objectively lucky. I mean, this guy, unlike the kid in The Holdovers who was abandoned by his family, this kid has a loving family. This kid has every advantage going for him. And he's still a dickhead. He's a total shitbag. And he makes every possible mistake throughout this movie. He lies, he cheats, he steals. He is spectacularly unreliable. He is a complete idiot. And I think that is genuinely the strength of this movie because, first of all, it's very Anthony Bourdain. Like, he had a very incisive eye in his writing, and he turned it on himself as well as everyone else, right? So it feels like him. It feels like what he would say.
Because it begins with that quote, doesn't it, when he describes himself as a narcissist and a...
in desperate need of an ass kicking.
Right.
Yeah. And that is 100% the kid that we see. And I think that's... that, if anything, makes you feel more affectionate towards him because he is such a dick. But it kind of reminds you of, like, genuinely being that young and that much of an idiot and having that little understanding of the world that you think this is a valid way to live. Do you know what I mean? And it's sort of, and there's almost a beauty to that very shitheadedness. I genuinely can't quite explain it, but there is really something quite touching and innocent about his absolute faith in his own greatness without any sign of any greatness at any point. And I find that quite endearing. And as the film goes on, you do see him get knocked on his ass repeatedly, deservedly.
Literally and figuratively.
And it sort of feels like this might be the thing that makes him and this might help. So this is not one of those films or those sort of biopics where somebody's going, we've got to keep this kitchen confidential, kids, and sort of like signaling what's coming in the future. There's none of that. There's very, very little. He's only referred to really as Tony. He corrects anybody who calls him Anthony. You know, he is not that guy yet. And the film is not sort of tipping its hat over and over again to that guy. But it is showing you how this dickhead might one day become that guy. And I thought that was a really, really clever way of approaching it.
Oh, he'd be a good Wolverine.
It's, you know what, he might not be a bad Wolverine. He definitely has the sideburns for it. It's also not like a complete Bourdain origin story, is it? It's basically one summer in his life when he went to Providencetown and worked in a restaurant. Yeah. And yes, a pivotal moment in his life, but it is just one small chapter long before he kind of made a name for himself. I didn't have a huge amount of Bourdain knowledge going into this.
Did you go to Bourdain school?
Very good. I did not go to Bourdain school. I really liked the trailer for this. Like, it had that kind of hazy 70s, almost A24-y vibe to it. And something about it just appealed to me. This, in spite of the fact that it is directed by Matt Johnson. Now, Matt Johnson did Blackberry, which I quite enjoyed, but he also, of course, made Nirvana, the show, the series, the lobotomy, whatever it was, woohoo! Which I think we can all agree is one of the most aggressively unfunny films ever made. And what's interesting about this is when I came out of this and really liked it, all of the people in the office who were massive Matt Johnson fans were disappointed that it didn't feel like a Matt Johnson film. It didn't feel like his stamp was on this film.
What does that mean?
Well, quite. Because he does have a kind of slightly wacky zany off-kilter sensibility.
But I don't think BlackBerry has that.
Which it has a bit of that in there. Wow. It does have a bit of that in there. Not to the way that Nirvana has in that, you know, it's good. But this doesn't have any of that in it. But actually, it really works because this has a woozy, 70s-y feeling. It's almost got, it's got this very dreamlike quality. And I really, really enjoyed that. It's not a narratively driven story. It's a hangout thing. He's in this kitchen. He's miserable. Like, you know, he's shucking oysters. He's washing dishes. But something about it is weirdly hypnotically compelling. And he, as a character, as Helen said, he is a grade A bellend. He is utterly unlikable, but, and it, again, a great bit of casting. What Cesar does is he gives him, first of all, he has a hangdog energy, kind of bathed in pathos. And you can't help but root for him, even as you want everyone to punch him. And I think that's a really hard thing to pull off. And so actually, I thought this was great. And we, like I say, people were maybe disappointed with the lack of Matt Johnsoniness to it. We gave this 3 stars. I think that's a bit harsh,
I think,
to be honest with you. Mm. I'd give this 4.
So you would take the star of Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie?
I would take all of the stars off that and give them all to this one.
Good movie. Really good movie. Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
This is also a really good movie. Yay, Matt Johnson.
Yay, Matt Johnson.
3 stars then. 3 stars then for Tony. Hell's Bells, tell us about, there are 2 more movies to talk about. Mm-hmm. One is called Lady. She's a lady. And the other one is Sunny Dancer.
Yeah.
So, tell us about those, but don't get them mixed up.
I will try not to. Lady is a mockumentary. It's directed by Samuel Abrams, who also lends his name to one of the characters in the film. The director within the film, played by Laurie Kinnaston, is also called Sam Abrams.
What?
And he turns up with a crew to this stately pile to film Lady Isabella, played by Sean Clifford from, you know, Fleabag, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And she is this wildly eccentric, weird, slightly sad lady who is convinced she's worth talking about and convinced she's worth people seeing. And she hosts a talent show every year for kids called Stately Stars, as in a sort of strictly stately kind of a thing.
Okay.
And has decided to enter it herself. So as well as judging the talent show, she will also be entering it. And it's they're following her as she's trying to find a talent for herself. And it's kind of a ridiculous character study to begin with. And then some weird stuff happens on top of that, that I won't spoil. So this, I thought, was already kind of a weird little dude of a film. Wait, and then it became an even weirder little dude.
This
was
a Dan Stevens in movie form.
It was, yeah, this is it though. It starts as like a Dan Stevens and then it ends up more of a Clint Howard. I think that's a good way of putting it. But it's very strange. But it's quite likable. And there is emotion in there as well. And the documentary maker is wildly conflicted about his own role in proceedings and unethical at times as well, which kind of makes it more interesting. But yeah, I just enjoyed this. I wasn't sure what to expect, but it definitely wasn't what happened. So if you want to be surprised, this is the one to see this week.
What did we give it?
We gave it 4 stars.
4 stars.
I'll be honest. I might have given that 3 and Tony 4.
But it's on the
borderline. So I'm not going to argue too hard with that.
Okay, 4 stars then for Lady. Really interesting that that's what it's about. I once tried to enter myself in a talent competition, and as a result, I was disqualified.
Probably for the best, really. Yeah. Shouldn't be doing that in public.
They frown upon that sort of thing.
They do.
Yeah.
The other film out this week, this other small film, is Sunny Dancer, which is written and directed by Georges Jacques, who is apparently 26 years old. He's another disgustingly young.
This cannot be allowed to continue.
This is appalling. I'm appalled.
Young people should be in front of the camera, like Dominic Sessa.
Indeed.
Not behind the camera.
Well, one such person, in fact, several such people are in front of the camera here.
Few.
This is led by Bella Ramsey, who plays a teenage cancer survivor. And her parents, who are played by James Norton and Jessica Gunning, are worried that she's not making friends. You know, her people her own age can't really relate to what she's been through. She can't really relate to what they haven't been through. It's a whole kind of gulf. So they send her away to a camp for teenage cancer survivors up in Scotland, run by Neil Patrick Harris. And there she falls in with a group of other kids played by the likes of Daniel Quintoy, Ruby Stokes, Earl Cave.
It's a good cast.
Yeah, it's a good cast. Yeah. And she basically, you know, begins to slightly come out of her rather angry shell and, you know, tentatively begin to make friends. I will be honest, I could see at least one of the major sort of plot points of this film coming from the summary, and you maybe can too if you're watching this or if you're listening to this. But I still thought it was pretty effective because I think Bella Ramsey gives a great performance here. I think there's a real sense of like community and bonding between the kids. They're all just so wonderful, and the thought of any kid going through what they've been through is naturally upsetting.
Yeah.
So it gets you right in the feels, as they say. It is also very funny. It's just a charming little British comedy, you know, and we don't get too many of those to the pound these days. So I just thought it was well done. It's not, like I say, it's not going to reinvent the wheel. It's not, you know, going to stun and surprise you with its narrative twists and turns. But it has its own point of view, and I think it does it pretty well.
Amazing. What would you give it, or what have we given it?
We have not yet got the Empire review up. It should be up, okay. I imagine, by the time you listen to this. I think it's another sort of high three, low four for me, somewhere in there.
Somewhere in that region. We'll find out by going to the Empire website, empireonline.com, to find out exactly what we gave it. But Helen would be high three, low four for Sunny Dancer. All right, one more film to talk about this week. It is David Robert Mitchell's The End of Oak Street. Jimbo.
Hello.
Tell us about this movie. I thought that was implied.
Oh,
you send your name in that
way. You were not specific. No. Yes, he has got, roughly 100,000 times the budget he had on It Follows, but he has made a film about dinosaurs. And the thing that strikes me about this film, before we even get into the story of it, is remember the end of Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, where it sets up a world where dinosaurs are roaming suburbia. And we were really excited to see where it went, and instead we got Jurassic World Dominion. I feel that this film finally fulfills the promise of that promise and shows us what would happen if dinosaurs ran amok in suburbia. So this sees the Platt family. You've got mother Denise, played by Anne Hathaway. You've got father Greg, played by Ewan McGregor. It's 1982. They're having cookouts. Their kids are riding around on BMXs. Their kids specifically Brian and Jeanette, and they're having some marital difficulties. He's off delivering pizzas. He's lost his job. They're having some sort of frictions at the home. But all of that pales into insignificance when their entire neighborhood is transported back to kind of the Jurassic era where dinosaurs roamed the earth. And I kind of, what's the best part of this is that while they are obviously transported back in time, it's kind of like we are too, because it's set in 1982, but it is also a film from 1982. Everything about this is like a Spielbergian Amblin homage, like everything from the pacing to the plotting to the Michael Giacchino's score, which is very plinky plonky and incredibly Amblin and 80s, as they wake up one morning and find there are dinosaurs in their front garden. And what I quite like about this from a dinosaur point of view is you see that David Robert Mitchell, he's not completely shed his gorier tendencies. Like, there's some gnarly kills in this, but all in all, he's done different things with dinosaurs, because I think what Spielberg did with Jurassic Park, unfortunately for everyone else, is ruin dinosaurs for every other filmmaker, because his T-Rex has a specific look and a specific sound and an identity. His raptors, even if they're not, you know, scientifically accurate, they are dinosaurs for us now. And anytime you use those dinosaurs, and let's be honest, there's only a certain amount of great dinosaurs to choose from, you feel like you're in Jurassic Park.
Whoa.
I'm sorry, Helen's going to put one in for the Allosaurus.
I mean, come on.
But what I really like that's done here is the dinosaurs here have a different aesthetic to them. They feel more rugged. They feel more feral. They feel more savage. They feel more horror. And I think that was a really smart move. Like, you've got the much more sort of feathered looking raptor beast. The T-Rex looks like some mutant monster.
But I think they're recognizably dinosaurs. I think they're recognizably the species that they're meant to be. Whereas something like the Adam Driver movie,
65,
reinvented the dinosaurs. And so you couldn't really tell what species they were, because they deliberately futzed with them, they deliberately play with them. But here, apart from the fact that they have feathers, it's like, oh, that's a Spinosaurus, that's an Ankylosaur. Yeah, I can tell
you
what they are.
You can recognize what they are from a paleontological point of view, but what I'm saying is they're not the Spielbergian archetypal dinosaurs that I think we're used to seeing.
Yeah.
And I think that benefits this film enormously. And it's fun. It's part horror movie, part adventure. It's one of the most fun I've had in the cinema this year, actually. Like, it's a really good laugh. And also, they use some, shall we say, dinosaur archetypes that we're not used to seeing.
Yeah.
one in particular that I will not spoil, which was a lot of fun and also incredibly upsetting. But yeah, really fun film, great dinosaurs. It feels like the Jurassic franchise has... I mean, look, I like Rebirth, but I feel like it has been done to death a little bit. And this made me think, oh, actually, there is life in the dinosaur movie yet.
Yeah.
And you can do this without feeling like you're retreading Jurassic ground. And that's something to celebrate.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really fun. I think there are some very funny moments in this movie, but without losing the tension of, you know, people are trapped here and have no idea if they will ever be able to get home. And they don't know how they got here in the first place. There's no real explanation. There's a bit of chat about wormholes and Carl Sagan, but that's like, that's it. And then they're kind of just trying to survive. And I think it does a really interesting thing, because it kind of does, you know, I thought it would be more like The Last House that we saw last week, which was with the family stuck in their house, you know, and that was all about how do you survive with just what you have. There's an element of that here as well. They immediately lose power and water, and they're just, okay, so what food do we have? You know, but it's less about that, and it's more about, fuck, there are dinosaurs, and they're really scary. I have questions about the number of carnivores in a very small area, if I'm honest. But we're going to let that aside, because it just makes for
a cooler
movie.
Doesn't seem like a sustainable ecosystem, really, does it?
It doesn't seem like a sustainable ecosystem. How are they all finding meat? Do you know what I mean? It doesn't seem right.
But this is
why Bodine's closed.
But they're coming from a much, much bigger area outside.
Well, but there's like a bit of a cliff. There's a bit of escarpment on at least two sides.
Maybe all the carnivores smelled them from miles away.
Yeah, and maybe we smell like delicious Soho special to them, I guess.
They were like, five guys. The other one was like, no, there's at least 30 or 40 of them. Wait. We can eat them all.
Well, it's 2 mile. Anyway, but... I just really enjoyed it. I thought it was very, very Amblin-y. It has elements of, obviously, like, Back to the Future with the time travel, Jurassic Park, obviously, with just the fact that there
Gremlins,
are dinosaurs.
Gremlins, Goonies.
Mm. Like, it just feels like very rooted in that time zone, that aesthetic. I think but it doesn't feel as slavish and pastiche as some of the Stranger Things and other ripoffs that we've had in recent years have done. This has its own point of view, and it feels like it's doing its own thing on top of that. And I really appreciated that.
It has that also 80s thing. It's like, how did all this happen? And they're like, it's the 80s. Who gives a fuck? And I quite enjoy, there's a layer of absurdity to this, which just feels so of its era. But yeah, it's a really, really fun time at the cinema. Mm. And it's a shame that I would say most people probably don't know what this is. Like, it doesn't feel like this is, because this could have been a tentpole summer movie, right? This could have been one of the big movies you're looking forward to. And it feels like it's snuck up on people with a fairly generic title.
Yeah, I was surprised by the scale of the movie. I've seen a movie, everybody. Hey. I've been off for a little while. I haven't seen everything, but I've seen this movie. Went along and saw it last night. And I was surprised by the scale of it sometimes. Mm. So this clearly cost quite a bit of money. And it feels like it's been hung out to dry a little bit in the summer season. I might be wrong about that. It might do really, really well this weekend, although it's up against the behemoth that is Spider-Man Brand New Day, which I guess nobody saw coming. People knew it was going to be a big deal by its third weekend, but I don't think they knew quite how big a deal it was going to be. And, you know, the trailers were a bit generic and a bit like, what is this movie? And haven't we seen this thing before? And there hasn't been a lot of promo for it. So I think it's important that people like us exist and platforms like this podcast exist for us to tell you that you should stop doing whatever it is you're doing right now and rush to your nearest multiplex and plonk down your hard-earned cash to see the end of Oak Street, because this movie is fan-fucking-tastic. It is my favorite film of the year so far. I adored it. I cannot wait to see it again. I found it funny. I found it scary, which is really interesting, because I think that one of the things that Jurassic franchise has done over the years is de-scare dinosaurs. First Jurassic Park, they're terrifying. And then it's like, oh, it's raptors doing their thing again. And now we can control the raptors and they're our friend. So they're less scary and they have to make up these mutant monstrosities in order to, you know, to frighten audiences and indeed the characters. And this actually makes put a baseball cap on. M, DSA. Make dinosaurs scary again. That's what the end of Oak Street does. David Robert Mitchell hasn't directed for a while. He's about to direct Lay Follow, which is a sequel to It Follows. And the fact that he has had this in his back pocket, maybe, James, he saw Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom and had exactly the same thought you saw and then when you had, and then when he saw Dominion he was like, that's not what this movie should have been.
No.
And then he went home and he wrote the movie that it should have been.
Good for him.
And good for him indeed, because I think this is beautifully directed as well. I think there are very, very few dud choices that he makes in the movie. There's a he deploys split diopters in a very interesting fashion, but I love it. I'm a big split diopter freak, so I was very, very happy with
that. Isn't that one of the dinosaurs?
I think it is. Split Dioptosaurus. And you know, he makes great choices with suspense sequences. There are some genuine surprises in this film. He does have to tiptoe around the PG-13 restraints quite a bit, but he does it very, very nicely indeed. He sets up the first 20 minutes. I was thinking, my God, the algorithm must be furious with this film because there's no action in the first 15, 20 minutes. It's all set up. It's all character-based. And the algorithm must be going, no, but something exciting has to happen in the first 2 minutes, otherwise people will switch off. But no, not the end of Oak Street. But believe me, all the exciting stuff happens in the last hour and 20 minutes of this movie. It's a thrill ride. It's got great characters that you can root for as well. And it's just great. And it's got a lovely dog as well. A lovely dog called Starbuck. Such a good dog. And such good dinosaurs as well. 14 out of 10 for the dinosaurs. Only a facetious, attention-seeking idiot would say things like, this is the best Jurassic Park movie since Jurassic Park.
Right.
And things like, this is the best Spielberg movie in decades. But I am a facetious, attention-seeking idiot, so I'm going to say it. This is the best Jurassic Park movie since Jurassic Park and the best Spielberg movie in decades, even though Spielberg is not involved with this film. I loved it. We gave it 4. I say piffed and poo-poo to that. I'm going to give 5. 5 Hewitts. 5 out of 5 Hewitts for this. 5 guys. 5 guys.
Oh God, it all comes back to 5 guys.
It all comes back to food in the end.
We are not sponsored by 5 guys.
We should be, though.
God.
We should be. They should sponsor our live show, our next live show.
We have a live show coming up. Tell us more, Chris.
We do have a live show, Helen. Why, thank you for that very organic segue. Yes, we are doing a live show Saturday, September 5th, King's Place, London. It is part of the London Podcast Festival. It is going to be an absolutely belting evening. There are still some tickets available for that. So if you haven't seen an Empire Podcast live show before, it is a ton of fun. Come along and see that. And if you have been before, then come along and have a ton of fun again. It's going to be tons of fun. Tons of fun all round. And we will be sponsored by 5 Guys. We won't be sponsored by 5 Guys. No. But Helen will personally spring for a burger or a vegan option for everybody in the audience.
I will not. No,
Helen will not. All right. So
we will invite you all down to Bodine's for a special.
We'll meet you in Bodine's.
Which Helen will pay
for. Oh, poor Bodine's.
No. Just in case they reopen, I need to make this clear.
I mean, frankly, you wouldn't be able to afford them at this point.
Oh, well, come
indeed.
On. Anyway, so 5 stars for our live show in September 5th at kingsplace.co.uk to get tickets for that. And 4 stars officially from Empire for the end of Oak Street. Ignore the generic title. Just put Jurassic World in front of it and you will be fine.
Jurassic Street.
Jurassic Street.
That's what it should have been called.
Is it real? Actually, is it the Jurassic that they go back to? Do we know? Is it the Triassic?
Triassic
Street.
It's hard
Street.
To tell. Oh, they should have called it Cul-de-sac, but C-U-L-L.
Mm. Oh.
Cul-de-sac.
Then it makes it sound like they're culling a bag.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because cool is like in that color.
All right, fine. Sorry. Jurassic Street. 4 stars then for the end of Oak Street or Jurassic Street or Cul-de-sac, if you want to consider that. And on that note, I think that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. I'm not around next week.
Oh, okay.
Hooray!
Off again, is it?
I will be in Lyon, but this is an actual holiday, whereas previously I've been working. I've been doing some work. But I'll be in Lyon next week, earning 20%.
You will be the Lyon professional.
Yes, I will be.
Luckily, there are many films to talk about while you're gone. So many films next week.
So many, many films. You'll be in safe hands with Helen and James next week. And we will be joined by...
Wow. killed Chris.
I might not be around ever again. Bye. Jane Schönbrunn.
Ooh.
Director of Teenage Sex and Death at Camp Miasma. That's exciting. But there's also about 847 other movies out next week. I have picked the perfect time to take a week off. And we'll be joined by some people from those movies, including Jujubee and Ginger Minj from Stop That Train! And they'll be on the interviews.
Hurrah! So,
until we meet again, until then, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my two colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye, Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
Goodbye, James Dyer.
Goodbye, Chris. Listen to the Pilot TV podcast.
Why,
not for any particular reason, just because it's great.
Yeah. Maybe listen to it while you're queuing up to get tickets.
Don't listen to it for the past 2 weeks because I wasn't on it, so it was rubbish.
Oh, it improved measurably. A real uptick, a real surge in listeners, yeah. I hear.
You listened to it.
So yes, there was one extra listener. It was me. That's exciting. Well done, James. Well done. Yeah. And it's goodbye from me as well. I am off to go down to Poland Street and just stand outside Bodine's and stare at it wistfully, forlornly, a single tear running down my cheek. Oh, so ho special. You were special. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.